Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Hello, and welcome to episode 255 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with three individuals at Dance Place in Washington, D.C., Carla Perlow, Deborah Riley, and Christopher Morgan. Carla is the co-founder of Dance Place and the founding director emeritus. She is a dance artist, choreographer, and teacher, former panelist at the National Endowment for the Arts, and is a former curator for the National Performance Network's Performing America's International Exchange Program. Carla, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jordan.
Deborah is the director emeritus of Dance Place and a former artist in residence at Dance Place. She was awarded the Pela Narensky Award for Lifetime Achievement in Dance and is a choreographer, performer, and educator. Deborah, thank you for joining us today.
Pleased to be here.
Now, Christopher is the executive artistic director of Dance Place, an artistic and executive director at the Christopher K. Morgan and Artists, and a resident company of Dance Place. He's a former dance artist in residence at the University of Maryland and is a dance administrator, choreographer, educator, facilitator, curator, and performer. Christopher, thank you for joining us today. How are you?
I'm wonderful. It's lovely to be here with you.
Excellent. So I guess I'd like to start, Carla, by asking you an initial question, which is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done? And in this case, perhaps with a greater emphasis on what you've done here at Dance Place to advance the public interest and why?
What I'm currently doing, besides teaching, and I'm teaching dance and horticulture and gardening, is I'm opening a pop-up shop for visual arts on 3510 12th Street, and will be open Thursday evening, October the 19th. And so I have had a lifetime of creative placemaking, going into places that have been underutilized and activating them with different types of art.
Creative.
Obviously with Dance Place, it's been dance. But we've also branched out into music and to visual arts.
Creative placemaking. Deborah, can you speak for a moment about how this has become, if it is, has been for you, a creative place for you? You came here as an artist in residence at Dance Place. Can you speak about the initial, manner in which you became known to Carla and how you came to be at Dance Place and if this place has been a creative place for you?
Definitely a creative place for me. I've had a very rich and rewarding career as an artist and as an administrator and leader here in D.C. I came because I met Carla through performing here at Dance Place. The previous owner-director of the physical space, Jan Van Dyke, invited myself and my collaborator to come and teach and perform here. And so I met Carla in that way, established a good relationship, and then Carla invited me back to teach and perform for a number of years before I made a decision to actually move here. And when I moved here from New York, I was very open and grateful to open the blinders of a, I'll just say, pretty focused downtown postmodern dance artist focused on dance and the professional dance community, and moving to Dance Place and being able to include in my scope of work, in my scope of teaching and curating and working with the community, people in our neighborhood, people of low income status, children, adults, families, and throughout the whole D.C. area, that was personally enriching for my life, because I feel very strongly that everyone, no matter what your background, no matter your resources, should have the opportunity to express themselves through the arts and, of course, the power of dance.
Now, Christopher, I see you nodding your head. Of course, Deborah speaks about having come to Washington from New York City. There are many, perhaps in the United States, New York City may even be referred to as the Mecca of dance. And yet she would leave that center to bring dance to low-income individuals. You also have your own company, Christopher K. Morgan and Artists, and you have traveled around and performed in around the globe. What is it that brought you to Washington, D.C., that led you to ground yourself in Dance Place?
What first brought me to Washington, D.C. was creative opportunities. You were talking about this being a creative place. And I think it's interesting because by many appearances, you know, D.C. is our nation's capital. It's a place of government. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of industry and business here and NGOs, but it's also an incredibly creative place. I think it actually is the salve to all of that other business. In fact, it creates balance, our creative economy here, and all of the wonderful riches that I found here. I first came to Washington, D.C. in 1998, which is when I first encountered Dan's Place. I was here as a dancer for another organization, but I immediately recognized the power of this place. Mm-hmm. And so having watched it evolve and grow and transform over the last 20 years that I've known it, mm-hmm. and now to have this wonderful opportunity to engage with it in a new and deeper way is incredibly exciting. It's a huge attraction for me as an artist and also someone who's trying to support and facilitate other people's art. And I think it speaks to the decentralization of that mecca of New York City. It's a mecca for many industries, right? And so I think something that I've witnessed in my creative practice in my industry is that actually, even though that is still seen as a mecca, great work is happening all over the country in communities and all over the globe, in communities large and small. And I think Dan's Place has been a real catalyst mm-hmm. and a sustained supporter of great art of all disciplines here in the Washington, D.C. area.
Now, I see that Dan's Place is clearly a very special place. For our listeners who don't know, and I'll open this up to all three of you, what is Dan's Place and what is so special about it?
It's a home for creativity, for education, for opportunities. And as the name suggests, the main vehicle for that mm-hmm. is dance. Mm-hmm. We have performances every single weekend. We have classes every day. Mm-hmm. We have an extensive youth program. We're highly engaged with our community and community revitalization. And we have many outreach programs from here that go into the schools and other community settings. I'm going to let Deborah talk about the resident artists and the services to artists.
Before I do that, I'm going to physically describe. Coming to Dan's Place is walking down a pretty residential neighborhood close to the metro. Mm-hmm. You come to our building and you know that creativity happens here. We have gardens that Carla and the children mm-hmm. so beautifully have planned and take care of. Mm-hmm. You see public art benches and canopies and lights and trash disposal systems on our campus, a beautiful paved walkway. That says creativity, and it says different energy in this mostly residential neighborhood located very close to institutions of higher learning, to mm-hmm. universities nearby. So physically, you're coming to a neighborhood, you're coming to a specific neighborhood. But in addition to our neighborhood, we serve the whole United States with our artists. So from what Carl was speaking of, our resident car companies that are based here in D.C. Mm-hmm. as Christopher K. Morgan and Artists and other six other companies that are based here, plus guest artists that come from all over the country and sometimes internationally.
I hear a lot of themes about giving back to the community, about how Dan's Place isn't a place located in a vacuum, but rather within, it is grounded within this particular community, and it's through the services community that you achieve a lot of meaning as a creative place. But I look at all three of you, and I see that clearly you are each dancers, and you must enjoy dancing. I'm wondering when if there's any difference when you're practicing and dancing by yourself, or if you have the place to yourself late one night and you're dancing, if that's any different versus when you're dancing in front of an audience and giving back. Is there anything that you're able to, I guess, pull in as a dancer where you're not sharing it with anyone and just having that experience versus the difference when you're dancing and you're sharing it with somebody?
That's a wonderful question. Absolutely. I think one of the things for me as an artist that's important is the dialogue with an audience. Mm-hmm. And so though I get a lot for myself out of private moments of creativity and I'll call it creative exploration, which is a lot of that choreographic process sometimes, for me that cycle is never complete. And different artists might feel differently about this. But for me, I've never felt like the cycle is complete until there's a witness. And in that witness becomes a dialogue, a real exchange. And I think that really speaks to the presence of an arts community center in a neighborhood. One of the things that I thought a lot about as I went through the very rigorous application process for my new job was that dance place to me is a lot like a pebble dropping into a still pond. Mm-hmm. And it has started small, kind of gutsy and brave and intense, and it's continued to grow with these concentric circles rippling out. So my colleagues here just spoke about the different layers of community that we work with and serve, from our immediate neighborhood to the national dance scene, to the international dance scene, and lots of ways in between that in a very porous way. Mm-hmm. So I think about that small stone that gets dropped and how it speaks out. That small stone that gets dropped in isolation, for me as a dance maker and a mover, it doesn't ring as loudly as when I can finally put it in front of people and have that dialogue with them. For me, that's a very important part of the creative process.
Sure. And for Carla and Deborah, I guess, what is it about this dialogue, about this giving back and advancing the public interest through dance, through creativity, by sparking that? What is it that, I guess, adds more meaning to you? Yeah, I see you nodding your head, Deborah.
I call it the power of dance. Mm-hmm. Dance is so powerful for addressing your expressivity, your emotions, what you go through in life, changes, breaking habits, opening your eyes to different environments and possibilities and relationships. When you are a mover and you delve deeply into the body and the body's capacity to learn, you begin learning on a whole nother level that is not so much just intellectual. It's mind-body synchronicity, and that power touches everybody. It doesn't matter if you're an experienced dancer or not. You feel something change. You feel the effect that is very visceral and has an outward expression, no matter who you are.
Now, Carla, I imagine when you came to D.C., there were many different locations already offering dance. There was the Washington School of Ballet. On 14th Street, there's a dance location. There are many different dance locations here. Why did you feel the need to create something new that was yours? And what was different about this place than the others?
Actually, Jordan, there were very few.
There were few.
You said there's the Washington Ballet. Uh-huh. They do something entirely different than uh-huh. what Dance Place does, because ours is focused on modern and contemporary dance and world dance, and not ballet. Mm-hmm. We have ballet for 3 to 5 year olds, but that is not what the focus of this is. And there are very few theaters that present dance, and when they do, it's often sporadic, maybe once a month, maybe 3 times a year. Mm-hmm. There are very few presenters of dance. We're one of the most prolific presenters of dance, and our theory was, let's have performances every weekend so that we can grow an appetite for dance and grow an audience for dance. And there are so many companies locally, nationally, and internationally that are seeking opportunities that we felt it was important to have an abundance of opportunities for these wonderful companies.
Tell me about this appetite and this audience that you've been able to grow over the course of the past few decades in Washington, D.C. for dance.
Mm-hmm. When you're in New York City, there is a real thirst and an appetite for the performing arts. And it's probably because people live in small apartments, and so they're out all the time, and there's a lot of it. In Washington, there is a lot of dramatic theaters. Mm-hmm. There are very few dance theaters and dance presenters. But we are finding more and more that the more we do and the longer that we are in business and doing this exciting work, that the audiences are growing.
Do you have any stories about particular audience members or little dancers who grew up to give back to the dance community? I'm sure you've seen generations of this community cycle through Dance Place, and you've seen, what sort of stories do you have about the people who have been impacted by this institution?
I'm going to let my colleagues speak, but you're looking at Christopher K. Morgan. There's a perfect example. When he was a young dancer, he performed, this was one of the first places that he performed, and now he's a seasoned professional with international and national touring, and now he's the director here. So that's a perfect example of someone who's come through Dance Place and is now directing Dance Place. And I'll let them speak about some of the other important artists that we have nurtured and supported through their development.
Dance Place has been around for 37 years, 31 years in our current location here in the Brookland Edgewood neighborhood. And so with that span of time, you can see a lot of matriculation through our programs or even a return to our programs. One example that I would love to bring up right away is a fantastic gentleman who teaches in our Children's Education Center, who's a neighborhood young man, as a neighborhood young man, encountered Dance Place and Carla and her Energizers program, which is an after-school youth enrichment program. So Delonte White now, 18 years later, teaches in that program, having gone through it himself as a young man. And I just spent some time with them in the Children's Education Center a couple days ago, which is a part of our arts campus here, mm-hmm. and provides after-school programming for 25 youth 5 days a week. It's a really wonderful program. He's masterful with these young children. Mm-hmm. So it's a great testament to how through our educational programs, someone can find a place over time. And there's many examples of that. One of our board members is similar, in fact, and a woman who runs one of our companies in residence for youth, Donna Kearney, who runs our STEP team, is another example of that. And then there's professional artists that have been in our space that have gone on to do wonderful things for the field at large. Maybe Deborah wants to share some of those anecdotes.
Yeah, there's well-known duet artists, Eiko and Koma. Mm-hmm. And they are Japanese-born, but have been living in the United States for decades. Mm-hmm. They are, at this point in their careers, decades into their mature careers and very well-known throughout the artistic and dance community. But everybody starts somewhere. And so some of their earlier performances at Dance Place were some of the earliest presenting at Dance Place as well, where their work, I'll say, is on the boundary of pushing the edges of what dance is. Mm-hmm. And it was a risk to present them, for Dance Place to present them, as we were growing audiences. But over the years, they returned, I'll say, for three other performances in the arc of their career, and then recently, in the past 3 years, Koma, who is the husband of the wife-husband team, mm-hmm. began to explore solo opportunities. He had never in his life, and he is well into his 60s, mm-hmm. never in his life made a solo. So he was awarded our Alan M. Kriegsman Creative Residency. He came, he was on site for a week, and he worked nonstop on a creation of a solo that was later performed in New York. His wife, Eiko, has had a very rich solo career. She came last year in our season to present her A Body in Places, which is interesting movement dance that happens on site, mm-hmm. out in the environment, out in the community, on the sidewalks, in the park. So that's an example of two artists that work together who have a very long arc of a career themselves personally, a very long arc in their career with Dance Place, mm-hmm. from when they were young to now as they are very mature artists.
And Dance Place has taken risks on artists that were undiscovered, like the Blue Man Group, which their first performance outside of New York City was at Dance Place,
really?
As part of a tour called the PS122 Tours. Mm-hmm. And an artist like Rennie Harris, who is now a seasoned professional in the hip-hop dance world, got his start here, and we're very proud of our relationship with him. One of my students, Tracy Inman, who was a student of mine when he was 17, mm-hmm. at the Duke Ellington School for the Performing Arts, went on to New York. He actually was a violinist when he started taking class with me. Then he decided to become a dancer. He went to New York. He danced with Judith Jameson. And then when she took over the Ailey Company, he danced with Ailey. And now he's the head of their education department.
What?
I thought it might be interesting to define what we mean by presenters and presenting for some of your listeners who may not be familiar with this specific aspect of our work. So we have a 144-seat theater that's very technically equipped, and as Carla and Deborah have mentioned, hosts performances about 47 weeks out of 52 a year, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And then as a dance presenter, it's a unique situation in that we actually invite artists to perform in our space, provide all of the support they need, whether that's technical or box office, the marketing support, as well as pay them a fee. Mm-hmm. And so this is unique. There are many ways to present your artwork as a dancer choreographer, but this is, you know, when we were talking about different institutions in our area that do participate as presenters, there are also rental houses. So I think one of Dance Place's strengths and why it's a leader in the national field is because we do have this really strong commitment to presenting dance, and that's what that means, is really supporting it in all of the different ways, technical, marketing, and the artwork itself, and paying for that artwork.
So I hear there's a business behind the dance. There's the creative element, but also you have to make ends meet for these dancers mm-hmm. and for these presenters, and you are providing services through instruction in the many classes you offer.
Mm-hmm.
Carla, you have, I'd like to ask you a little, we've focused so far a lot on the Washington, D.C. dance community. You've alluded a little bit to the New York City dance community, but earlier when I listed some of your former titles and accomplishments, you've received appointments on a national level. You've been involved as the curator of an international exchange program going down to Latin and South America. Can you speak about what these different communities, how you've been able to bring dance beyond Washington, D.C.'s boundaries and try to reach global audiences?
One of the greatest mechanisms for us is the National Performance Network. And it is just that. It's a network of artists and presenters that come together with an annual conference, and we share ideas about the business of the art and the artistry mm-hmm. of people that are touring. And through that organization, and for a while I was on that board of directors, but through that organization they have a project called the Performing Americas Project. And Deborah and I made an intentional decision that we wanted to do more international presenting. And this was an excellent vehicle for that. So the commitment was that I would travel with that group wherever they went mm-hmm. for 5 years. And we went to many countries, Cuba and Latin America, with the intent that we would bring companies back to the United States and that when possible we would foster an exchange of ideas and artists. And
kind of business development, bringing people back here.
Yes. And our business is art, so which is wonderful. And we've been very successful with that. We've had many exchanges mm-hmm. through the National Performing Network, Performing Americas Project. We've also worked with a variety of other organizations that are fostering a better understanding of people from different countries mm-hmm. with this type of international exchange. And because we're in Washington, and because we don't have a lot of red tape, we can make decisions quickly. We've been able to pick up artists that are on tour in the United States and put them into our season or made special performances for them.
Now, Carla, you've mentioned that you've taken risks bringing lesser-known groups such as the Blue Man Group, which is now a wide international commercial success, mm-hmm. but you've taken risks. And with risks, you have a chance of success and a chance of failure. And, of course, everyone knows that it is not always the easiest thing to secure a budget for an arts program. If you look at public schools, if something has to be cut, sometimes it's the arts. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Congress trying to cut down its budget, sometimes it will cut its funding for the National Endowment for the Arts or Maryland or any legislature. So I'd like to ask each of you about any time where you were ever worried that this dance place might fail or any large obstacles that you had. Was there times where things were difficult in the history of Dance Place where you were able to persevere, or times at least where you sacrificed a lot in order so that Dance Place might continue?
There have certainly been times where we've been challenged.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say many times when financially things were a bit dicey. We never, I'm very proud that we never closed our doors. We, I think, only on one occasion might have canceled a group because of funding falling out maybe once in 30 some years, which is pretty extraordinary. Mm-hmm. When we went through a time culturally in this country, and when we went through the recent recession, and prior to that, artist companies were folding. Mm-hmm. They couldn't exist. They were closing their doors. They didn't create any art. So I'm very proud that we got through all of those times, because we're such a lean organization. We have followed Carla's really good and strict business sense to keep the finances in rein, to still produce engaging and great art on a shoestring with the generosity of artists who will work with our situation. So my general statement is there's been many years that have been quite challenging.
I think that's just innate to the arts. Mm-hmm. It's extremely difficult. Art costs money. Mm-hmm. Art doesn't make money. Mm-hmm. So with every ticket, every performance that you see, you are paying for maybe a fourth of what it actually is costing to put that performance on. And so all the rest of that money has to be raised. And it has to be raised from government, foundation, corporations, and individuals. And it has to have both earned income and a huge amount of contributed income to make it happen.
So it's kind of like if you look at the metro system,
exactly.
It's every metro system in the world is publicly subsidized as a public service.
Mm-hmm,
it helps people get from the place where they are to the place where they need to be. In the artistic community, in a dance community, I wonder if that analogy might serve appropriately. That, again, this is a public service that must be subsidized to help people get from where they are to where they creatively and humanistically would like to be. Christopher, I see you nodding your head to that. What do you think?
I love that. It's a beautiful parallel to get from where you are to where you potentially could be. I think art is such a great mechanism for that. And, you know, this is a wonderful opportunity to look at the invisible benefits of what art does. To look at the invisible is what I just said. It's just an ironic statement in and of itself. But I think when you think about the costs of something, oftentimes immediately you look at what the benefit is, a cost-benefit analysis. And one of the challenges with art is that sometimes it's not quantifiable what you're paying for. Sometimes it is. We can look at audience numbers, we can look at number of students served, and those are useful data points that we're asked for regularly. But then the invisible benefits that go so far beyond what can easily be shared through data is, I think, where getting someone from point A to point B really happens. How a young person's sense of self is transformed because they have an opportunity for self-expression. How an artist's potential for growth is helped through a residency process, like what Deborah was sharing that Aiko Nkoma went through our AMK residency, for example. And then how that in turn benefits the viewers of that work, and they can see themselves reflected on stage. They can have an empathetic or an emotional response and an experience that just improves our quality of life. These invisible benefits are really hard to track, but have great importance, I think, in our society.
So as we approach the end of this podcast, I'd like to ask each of you a final two-part question in any order that you choose. What is it that has been motivating you? Clearly, perhaps you might have been able to do something different had you chosen purely a Alvin Ailey performance career in New York City. You could have chosen to do dance on the side as a hobby and have a corporate career during the day. You could have chosen other things that would have been less difficult and less public service oriented. Why is it that you have been motivated to give of yourselves in this manner? And then what is it that you hope will be the legacy and the impact of those decisions?
Mm-hmm. I'm from Washington, D.C. I'm actually from Hydesville, Maryland. And I did not want to live in New York City. And New York City did not need me. There are thousands of dancers that are my height and of my ability. Washington needed me. And early on, it was a selfish reason that I wanted a place where I could be creative, where I could dance, where I could teach, choreograph, and perform. And in order to do that, I had to create Dance Place. And while I was creating it, I knew that the most important thing for me was to be able to share it with other colleagues and build the field here so it would be an interesting place for me to live. The legacy, I hope, is that the younger generation under Christopher's direction will understand the value of creativity and community, because we are in such a technological age where it is hard to get young people to even look up from their screens. And when they do, and they find themselves in an audience, or they find themselves in a group on stage, they'll see the benefits of it.
I came to Washington, as I said earlier, early in the creation of Dance Place, and knew Carla and Dance Place as a visiting artist. I came here 6 years after the organization was founded and have been many years. So that's 30 plus some years. So, you know, what kept me engaged and what I feel is so important, I'm going to go back to it because I have a broken record about this, the power of dance. The power of dance to touch individuals, and as an artist teacher, that has always been a motivator to me, to see how people expand their own potential as a creative person, just as a human being, to find out more about themselves. I've also worked through dance with healing to various communities, women in trauma as one of them. So I see dance facilitating in that way, and the opportunities from Dance Place springing in that way. And currently I work with an aging population who have cognitive decline. So movement is extremely important to us, whether we are babies, toddlers, children, teens, young adults, mature adults, or aging part of our population. There's dance for everyone there, and it's so important to our lives.
I feel very fortunate that I was able to listen to a deep sense of inner drive, and that pushes me and inspires me for a lot of the work that I have done. It is what pushed me out on stage and pushed me out into the world as a performer and choreographer. As that drive has evolved but stayed ever constant, it's wanted to be in greater dialogue with other people, or in a different type of dialogue than my performing career allowed. And so I think that drive, which I'm really grateful is so strong, because sometimes I talk with colleagues and or even people from other fields, and they sense the waiver, the question of continuing in a certain path and feeling a need to maybe reinvent themselves. And within my own field, I've reinvented myself, and I feel so driven to follow this drive that now is asking me to dialogue and with and support other people's creative pursuits. I think that directly relates to what the legacy potential is. And I think that legacy is really not just my work and my own creative practice and pursuits, but an opportunity that I feel here at Dance Place to support the creative pursuits of many, many people. And to have the echo effect, I talked about the pond ripple before, that I think the arts uniquely is poised to have in the world at large, which is to really create better, stronger communication amongst people, and thereby having stronger, more vibrant, more well-integrated communities. I think art is uniquely poised for that possibility. I hope that's part of my legacy.
And that has been Carla Perlow, the co-founder of Dance Place, founding director emeritus, dance artist, choreographer, teacher. Deborah Riley, the director emeritus at Dance Place, a former artist in residence. And Christopher Morgan, the current new executive artistic director at Dance Place, the artistic executive director at his own eponymous dance company, and dance administrator, choreographer, educator, and so much more. And they speak about how their community needs them. And they're fundamentally engaged in a dialogue with their audience, a dialogue that is intended to reverberate across the community in order to create better communication among individuals. Similar to the mission of Public Interest Podcast is creating dialogue and the power of revealing our mutual humanity and acknowledging that in each other that drives these individuals. they mention a thirst for the performing arts that they're attempting to slake and also at the same time inspire in a Washingtonian and a global audience. The power of dance presents a paradox, says Carla, Deborah, and Christopher, a paradox where you're able to look at the invisible. And through dance, you can gain a sense of self, and through self-expression and providing a platform for self-expression, you're able to creatively explore what it is to be a human being. In that sense, Carla, Deborah, and Christopher each are seeking to advance the public interest. I'd like to thank each of you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
This has been another episode of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. I'll remind you to subscribe on publicinterestpodcast.com and on iTunes. Leave a review of this podcast on iTunes and listen on Stitcher, SoundCloud, CastBox, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Should you wish to comment on this episode, you're welcome to leave a voicemail at 240-630-0380. And the first 3 minutes of that voicemail may be played in future episodes of Public Interest Podcast. Should you wish to support the podcast, you're welcome to leave a contribution in an amount that you feel comfortable with at publicinterestpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.